Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. In this latest member profile, Anna Markey talks to us about her background in Australia, her time spent in India as a young woman, and her initial engagement with Buddhism. She then goes on to talk about her interest in language and her career as a teacher, why she joined the society, and what her understanding is of the Middle Way. Hello, Anna. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hi, Barry.
Okay, well, perhaps you could begin, Anna, by telling us, first of all, something about your background.
Okay, well, I was born in Australia, South Australia, and I still live in South Australia, so it makes me sound a little bit sedentary. But I was born in the desert, a place called Woomera, and the firstborn for my mother and father. And then probably the major thing that affected at least my early childhood was after my parents went to England for 2 years so my father could get his degree in surgery, my parents split up. So I became children of a single parent, which in those days was very unusual. I remember at school, nobody knew what the word divorce meant. So, right. So I lived most of my childhood as a child of a single parent, and that happened in England. But then we came back to Australia. I was born in 1955.
Yeah.
So we came back to South Australia. I went to school, etc., in South Australia. Then to Teachers College. And then became a teacher. Probably another major influence in my childhood, apart from just being the child of a single parent, was that when I was about 14, I developed a lump in my leg, which they eventually decided was cancer. Mm-hmm. So I had major surgery with that, a lot. And this really influenced my life, actually, but maybe I'll go into that a bit more later on. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, then I became a teacher. I went to a rural town in South Australia, about 4 hours from where my mother lived, and taught there for a couple of years. And there I really found, I really got into motorbikes, actually. I befriended the local kind of bike group and became a motorbike rider. And that was a very exciting part of my life. I travelled in all directions on my motorbike and, yeah, really enjoyed that. Then I went overseas and I went over to England and Europe, you know, worked in a kibbutz. This is in Australia, this is what people do. Yeah. In my generation, everybody either before or after they went to university had these gap years. But for Australians, it was often more than a year, usually a couple of years in those days.
Yeah. I went to kibbutz too, actually.
It
was quite a profound experience for me.
Yeah, well, it was for me too. It was the first time I'd learnt a second language, really. I learnt Hebrew as much as I could in those few months, and I was impressionable, I guess, and I almost converted to Judaism. My heart went out to them. I got really involved, read everything I could, learnt the language. But I had that tendency everywhere I went. I spent a couple of years, one year or more in Greece and worked on an island and lived in a cave and, again, learnt Greek. And then went to India, was really excited and involved in India. And, in fact, a couple of years later, after going back and working again in Mount Gambier and saving money, I actually went back to India and then eventually stayed in India for 2.5 years. And I kind of offered myself up as a volunteer worker. I tried with Mother Teresa first.
Me too. Did you?
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I actually, you know, India in those days, well, I suppose it still is, was quite chaotic. So I kind of lined up to go to Calcutta and The line was too long in the railway station, just really long. It almost took hours. So I hopped the other line and instead went to Dharamsala to work with the Tibetans. Wow. And that line hopping, you know, changed my life, obviously, as do lots of things like that. So I went to Dharamsala and it was in winter, actually. It was in January or something. And offered myself to the Tibetan government in exile as a school teacher, and they took me up on it. I ended up in a very small village in the foothills of the Himalayas, a settlement, mm-hmm. a refugee settlement, and ended up staying 2.5 years with those with that particular settlement of Tibetans. So there I guess, discovered Buddhism. I learnt Tibetan. I sort of absorbed myself in the culture as I did the whole way along my international experience. So, and that was life-changing as well, and took a lot of teachings with Tibetan teachers, et cetera, et cetera. And I was actually in India when Mrs. Gandhi was killed, so there were times of turmoil. I had holidays in Dharamsala, so I kind of kept up with the Dalai Lama and people in those days who were learning Buddhism and becoming Buddhist teachers. Yeah, so that was major.
Mm-hmm. And would you describe yourself as a Buddhist?
Yes, I would. And that was an interesting process too, because my teacher, my initial teacher, while I was absorbing myself in Tibetan Buddhism, I went to a retreat at Bodh Gaya with a Western insight teacher, Christopher Titmus. And I really think of him as my earliest teacher. Now, he doesn't describe himself as a Buddhist. He says he's a student of the Buddha, I think to avoid the ists and isms. Yeah. But, you know, my story was really a story of fear of commitment. You know, I wasn't very good at committing to anything. I was a little bit frightened of it in those days. So I turned it into a bit of a thing to commit to Buddhism. You know, I got a whole lot of candles and found a little stupa and lit the candles and actively committed to being a Buddhist. So in a way for me it was appropriate, to stop me flitting and floating between different philosophies.
Yeah, you say that you're now leaning more towards a secular dharma. How would you describe that process you've been through with Buddhism?
Okay, so you know, I started off in Tibetan Buddhism, and then after attending a retreat with Christopher Titmus, it was just I just realized that whole cultural overlay and ritual and sort of mysticism was just not for me. It's what was a little bit jarring when I was studying Tibetan Buddhism. Even the language, it just seemed like a huge cultural overlay. So then I moved to the insight tradition of Christopher, who just seemed to talk about practical ways to, you know, become awake, or practical ways to rest easier in the world, I guess.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it almost feels like a flow on. And from there, when I went back to Australia, as is still the case in Australia, of course, there's not every tradition of Buddhism available in every town. Yeah. It's sort of a guru-based tradition in some ways, which to some extent I'm kind of pushing against. But and I used to go across to the East Coast whenever Christopher came over to Australia. But in my town, there was either Tibetan Buddhism or the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh, the Zen tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh. So I joined the Thich Nhat Hanh group, and so for a couple of years, I was really practicing that kind of Zen with Thich Nhat Hanh. I eventually did go to his community in France, and Thich Nhat Hanh's tradition was very, very emphasizing interconnectedness, emphasizing mindfulness in a very gentle way.
Yeah.
But again, I don't think it suited me. In a way, I had a different aim, and I've only realized this recently, that from being through a near-death experience as a child, my aim I can really remember knowing I was going to die, which is what everyone around me assumed from this cancer I had, and thinking kind of, bother, you know, I can't realise my fullest potential. It felt like I had all this potential and it just wasn't going to be realised because I was going to die. So when I lived, my drive was probably around realising my fullest potential, doing the best I could with what I had. And that's a little bit different to the kind of seeking of happiness that I felt was at the basis of Thich Nhat Hanh's project. So, and it probably still is a little bit different to the Buddha's aim. You know, I still feel as if I'm happy enough. Probably through going through a near death experience as a child, it's easy for me to be content. But I had this drive to realize my fullest potential. So, I haven't lost your question. You were asking about secular Buddhism. So, you know, from Thich Nhat Hanh, I talked to Christopher and he said, look, if you haven't got the type of Dharma that you want, either move to the east coast of Australia where there's a whole smorgasbord or start a group in your town. So I started a group in my town. So from then on I was really working with a kind of Dharma that I thought was appropriate with my group. And, you know, again, that was in the year 2000, so it's been nearly 20 years that I've run groups here. And within that process, I also met a teacher on the East Coast who was Mahasi, and the Mahasi approach, Mahasi Sayadaw, again, within the Theravada tradition. And, you know, for a while it was like that approach really felt like something a little bit like, okay, you're cool. This teacher was really had his act together. So just tell me what you've done to get where you are and I'll do it and I'll get where you are kind of process. It seemed like obvious. And Mahasi was very prescriptive. You just do this and this and this and you'll get there. And at that stage I thought, oh, that's what I need to do, to be really disciplined and prescriptive and just follow the instructions and then I'll get where I want. And as a part of that process, I realised that's not the way it works, that you can't go step A, B, C, D and you'll get E. And I almost had to go through that process to realise it. So I tried that for a few years under the guidance of Patrick Carney. And again, I'm really grateful to all these teachers for being patient with me and letting me go through, in a way, stages. Then I met a teacher, Jason Siff, who had a very different approach in that it was a more receptive approach. You didn't do A, B, C, and D, and you kind of didn't do as you were told. You looked into your inner world to see what was going on. So you came to the Dharma through a point of understanding your own inner world and making choices around that. So his approach was very fresh. You couldn't go wrong. Like, it wasn't about getting rid of thoughts, getting rid of, you know, bad qualities or anything. It was about looking into and understanding what your experience was. So more based around dependent arising of the Buddha. And this approach really connected. It somehow took away all the paradoxes and incongruencies of all of the other approaches I took. So over the last maybe 10 years, I've worked with that approach with my groups here. Okay. Yeah. And that's more secular, Barry. That's you're not dependent on anything else. I'm also really affected by Stephen Batchelor's teachings.
Yeah.
I run a study group based on around his books. Right. And very earlier on, our groups used his book, Buddhism Without Beliefs, as a basis for our, you know, something like 2003 as a basis for our studies. So very slowly over time I realised that the project I wanted to work on was in this very life. Yeah. I wasn't interested in doctrines. I wasn't interested in theories. I was just interested in working with my experience and its interface with others.
Great. Okay.
So that's a long answer to your question about secularism.
Well, fascinating. And I'm just curious, at what point and to what degree did the notion of the middle way through this process you've been through start emerging?
You know, I always... again, I was quite an ardent student of the Dharma. I was kind of ardent at everything. It's probably one of my qualities. And so from the very beginning, even when I was within Tibetan Buddhism, I realized, you know, I learnt the teachings. I heard the Buddha spoke of the middle way. You know, I think my understanding then it was almost technical. And again, with Christopher, he might have presented it in a few different ways in his Dharma talks. So I kind of slowly got to understand that, you know, the Buddha wasn't into going to extremes. And there was the famous story that is told by various people, the one of where he was sitting on the side of the river and a lute player was floating down. I think this is how it goes. And the lute master was saying to the student, if you have the string too tight, it doesn't sound very good. If you have the string too loose, it doesn't sound very good. You've got to sort of get the string in the middle. And it was an aha moment for the Buddha. And that story is often told as a way of showing the Buddha wasn't into extremes, but often in the teachings I went through, especially in the Mahasi tradition, there was a real sense of the harder you try, the better you'll be. There was a sense of extremes. There was a sense of this is bad, this is good. You know, lazy is bad. Trying very, 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 very hard is good. Meditating once a day is not as good as meditating 10 times a day, et cetera. Even around meditation, you know, concentrating really, really hard is good and not concentrating at all is bad. So there was still a kind of a sense of extremes, even though there was that teaching. Yeah. So and very slowly as I became a kind of a teacher myself and gained experience, I guess, I started to see, you know, especially in terms of effort, I suppose was the first place, that I too was trying too hard and under the mistaken belief that if you try hard, you'll get big results.
Yeah.
And it was really, you know, in a way quite recently, maybe a few years ago, that it really connected the real sense. I guess I really started to embody the middle way of realizing that of what the Buddha said. And I read the sutta where he said it, and, you know, really connected with his sense of, I think he said something like, it is clearly seen but difficult to know, something like that, and clearly visible but difficult to see, some statement like that. And so I started to realise that this was about moderating as opposed to going to an extreme. And then a couple of years ago, in the groups that I teach, I take a theme each year, and I give every 2 months I give a talk on that theme. I did the Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, emptiness, dependent arising, and then I did the middle way. So for a whole year I explored the implications of the middle way teachings of the Buddha, and that's when I really connected with it. I really started to see that it was about not moderation as much as, I guess, refining or calibrating, that you move in a certain direction, oh, that's too much, and you move back in the other direction, oh, that's too much, and then slowly moderating not just one's take on experience, but qualities and interface with the world, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where I Googled the Middle Way Society when I realised this was a much more profound teaching than just moderation or compromise. It was it became a part of my life. It really became it was a huge shift in my life, and hopefully for some of my students.
To what degree are you open to the idea that the middle way, although perhaps it found its greatest articulation through the Buddhist teaching, but can be seen throughout history as just as an aspect of human experience and something that can be taught and promoted as a universal principle beyond the Buddhist tradition?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I don't think anything the Buddha taught belongs to the Buddha. I think he kind of just tapped into, as all great wisdom teachers have done, just tapped into something and fashioned it in their own way, which is what I'm doing with my history, the way I teach. So, yeah, I struggled to come up with a metaphor for it, but it's kind of a way of seeing the world. So maybe putting on a certain lens, a certain glasses, and seeing the world in that way, that makes it much easier. I'm using the word easy, but it's not the right word. Mm. To make it more congruous with the way the world is. And I definitely don't see that as the Buddha's discovery. He just tapped into it. There's a way of being in the world that makes one more congruent with the way the world works. And by being flexible, by being considerate and, really valuing the kind of that process of looking at the world and trying to fit in with it as opposed to going against it, I don't think at all belong to the Buddha. So, you know, I think the middle way is a lens that was useful for me. And as you say, if you look through history at any of the wisdom teachings, people weren't into the wisdom teachings that really, really connected with a large number of people are the ones that made life worth living or life a flourishing life. And to me, one has to be in the middle way in order to have a flourishing life. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. And I know that you're especially interested in how language ossifies our inner world and can lead us towards thinking in absolutes. Could you perhaps expand on that a little bit, Anna, and tell us any ideas you've had to try and mitigate that?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so again, it's been a growing process of seeing that, the effect of language, or, you know, seeing that it's a part of the me-making process. You know, of course, Buddhists are really interested in how we kind of ossify a sense of I. You know, I started to see that whole eye-making process was really dependent, I suppose, on the frontal lobe, the overdeveloped frontal lobe of human beings or whatever, the part of our brain that is very good at making symbols, of making metaphors or symbols or whatever, which has helped us with language, and how language or conceptualizing makes me and I make language or conceptualizing. So it's almost it is a cyclical process.
Yeah.
We don't tell our stories, our stories tell us, make us. Mm. So very slowly realizing that. And then as a part of my progress in the Dharma, but also as a part of really clicking into what the Buddha really meant by the middle way, I just started to see how language did this. And it happened, it was a part of that. In Tibetan Buddhism, in Zen, in a lot of the teachings I talk, the teachings were in the form of where the teacher tells you, you've got to be compassionate, you've got to be mindful, you've got to be whatever. And they use these words and then they make a definition of these words and you go off and you kind of fashion it. You're told you're supposed to be compassionate, so off you go and you fashion something that compassion with its definition has meant for you. And you kind of, and I started to see how words, the way teachers used words, really affected one's inner world. You trust them and you go off and fashion your inner world accordingly. You take on those qualities and the qualities depend on the definition. Someone says you have to be mindful. You say, what is that? They tell you what mindful is and off you go doing that, whatever they've told you. And I could see gradually that was a little bit incongruent with what I thought the Buddha was saying about dependent arising and about ignorance. You were really just taking other people's concepts, other people's frameworks. So, you know, when that hit me, and then when I found Jason Siff's approach, where you do it the other way around, a teacher doesn't tell a student, a teacher asks a student, what's happening in your world? You know, what's happening in there when you sit still for 3/4 of an hour, and what's happening in there? And he really encouraged us to use our own language, not to use words like craving, attachment, aversion, the jargon that, that Buddhism gives us. He encouraged us to use our own language and to say what is really happening, not what we wanted to happen or what we were constructing to happen. And, you know, in that way, I saw how much in the past that my inner world was constructed, not investigated. And then when I started investigating my inner world and coming up with my own words, I could see the power of that. And it's almost a kind of an act of liberation, really. You'll stop trying to fit definitions, and you're actually exploring what's really going on away from those definitions.
That just made me think of a book. Well, someone I interviewed a year or so ago, a guy called Jeremy Lent, and he wrote this book, The Patterning Instinct. And he was talking about how language can actually potentially change our brain structure. And he gave the example of a tribe in, I think it was in Papua New Guinea, who don't have the concepts of left and right, but they orientate themselves through the cardinal directions. So they might say, someone might say, where's the salt? And they say, oh, it's just to the north of you. What's interesting about that, they have got this innate sense of the north, south, east and west. Apparently, even if they're in thick cloud in the, you know, in a building or whatever, it's just they can do that.
How you're fashioned by your language. And the old story of, you know, the Eskimos have 68 words for snow and we just have two, you know. And I could really see that. I could really see there are places in my inner world that didn't have words, and if they don't have words, you don't see them. So, you know, this whole approach in the Dharma, I just thought was much more in alignment with what the Buddha's aim was around kind of being awake, is that you're actually looking at what's really there as opposed to what's supposed to be.
Yeah,
according to a doctrine, you know. And you know, the limits of language, you know, the things are either good or bad or right or wrong or happy or unhappy. And there's very few words in between. And, you know, I can see that really stopping people. And when I was a junior primary teacher, I used to see that with kids. Kids would say, oh, my drawing's bad, or this is really messy. And I'd say, well, you know, it's messy-ish, you know. And I started to bring the word ish into kids' vocabulary, so they didn't just decide they were good or bad at something, or if they were fast or slow, or, you know, as soon as you put ish in, if someone said, oh, I'm a really slow runner, say, well, you're slow-ish, you know, sometimes you could be fast and sometimes not. And how language divides the world into extremes. Yeah. And there's very few words in between, very few words even in between good and bad.
Yeah.
You know, you can say mediocre, but there's very few for the other grades.
I think another trap we fall into there potentially is that something like paradoxes are often seen as, you know, like, ooh, they're sort of otherworldly, and not that they could potentially be just a failure of our language to represent something that is somewhere in that messy middle. If I wrote on this piece of paper in front of me now, the sentence on the other side of this paper is false, and then turned it over and wrote the sentence on this other side of this paper is true. Now, you've got a paradox there, but I mean, it's nothing woo-woo about that. It's just an inefficiency of language rather than something mystical.
Exactly. And, you know, I could see the Dharma was just becoming so doctrinal that people had to fit their way of being in with a doctrine instead of the other way around, instead of really taking up the invitation to find out what's really going on in your own words. And, you know, it was a big revelation for me, really, to see this. And, well, you know, a little bit liberating to see you don't have to, you know, when someone says, well, you have to be compassionate in order to, you can think, well, my definition of compassion might not be the same as yours, kind of thing. And to look at places where you're tiny, tiny little bit compassionate, where your shift is really minute, but to have a big effect, as opposed to the capital C compassionate type thing. And I could see it's a trap. It's a real trap for people to be stuck in concepts.
As you know, I'm personally quite involved in the Extinction Rebellion movement. And Well, I just came across an article recently, though, by someone who was saying that you have to be careful that don't overdo the gloom and doom, because people can easily switch off. In order for us to change and be motivated, we need hope. So I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Okay, yeah, I know what you mean. And, you know, I really know what you mean, because someone recently just said, oh, it's these kind of statements drive me nuts, but it's un-Buddhist to hope, you know. And, you know, I immediately kind of react to that because I don't like those type of statements. But Roshi Joan Halifax just gave a talk in a conference I went to talking about active hope. And again, it's just your use of words. We could not call it hope. Someone's definition of hope might be that you have this image of the future that's unrealistic, that you've just built up in order to keep you going, in a way, to have an unrealistic expectation. She was talking about active hope. So to sort of set little goals, or to have expectations that are realistic, or that at least you know, may not eventuate, but give you enough energy to keep going. And so there's some kind of more, being a little bit more authentic, being a bit more realistic about it. And when you know how you operate, and everyone's different, there's some people that are really kind of can get really motivated by their anger, whereas other people are kind of crippled or embarrassed by it. So everyone has their own mode of operating. But, you know, I think setting small goals, having expectations. I mean, you know, I have an expectation that when I come home every day that my house is still there. You know, I mean, maybe one day it won't be. I mean, I know that it could burn down, but you might as well have an expectation and work on it. The interesting thing is what happens when it doesn't eventuate. So how we go with expectations that are not met. And I think that's where we need to really build up our resilience, to build up, especially in groups with like-minded people, where you're reinforcing each other. Well, that didn't work. Next. Yeah. As opposed to, you know, that doesn't mean we don't allow grieving, even have a process of grieving, process of what do you do when something doesn't work? Well, you grieve, you debrief with people, and then on you go.
Yeah.
So, you know, hope, like any word that with a capital letter, becomes ossified. But I think we can be invited to make it our own word and put a small letter as opposed to a capital, and allow ourselves to have different interpretations of it.
I also have been quite impacted by a quote by someone called Maria Popova about hope. She said, critical thinking without hope is cynicism, but then hope without critical thinking is naivety. And she tries to steer a path between those two polarities. And to me, that's a quite a good example, perhaps, of the middle way.
Yes. And it shows there's many different types of hope, you know, that each different person might have a different way of operating within that definition.
Definitely, yeah. Now, it's been absolutely fascinating, Anna, to hear your story, and I'm really pleased you signed up. Was it, you've been about 18 months now or something like that that you've been involved?
Yes. Yeah, well, I'm pleased too. Like I say, it was a revelation to me to really understand the implications, to go beyond a word with a definition and realise it's a whole way of being. Yeah, so it's nice to find like-minded people who kind of think the same, who discuss the implications as opposed to a definition.
Brilliant. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thanks, Barry. Yeah, good.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.